Distributing the Future, Beta Broadcast Number 6.
The future is going to be bigger than the past. There's going to be more happening. Connected systems, connected devices, connected data. What can we do in that world that will be interesting, powerful, and useful?
Changing the world through capturing the knowledge of innovators.
The future is here. It's just not evenly distributed yet.
Welcome to Distributing the Future from O'Reilly Media. I'm Daniel Steinberg, and each week we bring you the technology and the people behind what you use now and what you'll use next. This is part three of a series that highlights the recent Web 2.0 conference in San Francisco. In the next half hour, VC Vinod Khosla from Kleiner Perkins on Too Much Money. Into it, Scott Cook on learning from customers. Google's Sergey Brin on how they got where they are, on where they are, and on where their ideas come from. Dick Hart talks a bit about identity, and Safa Rashti talks to five teens about technology. Distributing the Future is brought to you by Make Magazine, technology on your time. In Volume 4, cool holiday kits, build a cigar box guitar, circuit bending, high-speed flash photography, coffee hacks, and lots of cool DIY music projects. Visit makezine.com. In last week's show, 37 Signals' Jason Fried talked about doing more with less. One of the things he recommended having less of was VC money. This week we have venture capitalist perspective from Vinod Khosla, partner at Kleiner Perkins. He agrees that too much money may not be good for you. On the third day of the Web 2.0 conference, he said,
"The amount of money in the venture capital business is still there, and I think it's more than is needed." So that leads to a word of caution for this audience, which is, just because you get funded doesn't mean you're successful. Just because you have money, remember not to spend it the way you did before. My caution would be, the right way to build a company in a new area is to experiment and experiment in small ways. So you have lots of room to make mistakes, to change strategies, to change what you're doing. And only when you're pretty certain you're tracking, you have traction, and start to take off, you start to really worry about scaling and other things. Just a word of caution, go back and read the lessons. The funny thing is, one of my good friends, Mark Leslie, who is the founder of Veritas, says the more money you give a company to start with, the less likely they are to be successful. Because the more confident they get about their business plan, the less they experiment and take critique and work hard to find out what are the flaws in your plan. Those things hold independent of whether you have money or not. So, and there's plenty of venture capitalists, more than there need to be, trying to give you money and pretending to be value add. Most of us don't know the businesses half as well as you do, myself included, especially your business.
Vinod Khosla of Kleiner Perkins on distributing the money. Of course, we're distributing the future. In what seems by now like a past life, I used to teach mathematics. I remember having coffee with professors after they'd graded an exam, and they'd be saying things like, "Well, I can't believe they all missed this question. I know I taught this." Of course, you and I know that if the students didn't learn it, then the professor can't really say that they taught it. In this next segment, Scott Cook, co-founder and CEC of Intuit, talks about what Intuit has learned by watching folks actually use their software products. It's helped them take their tax software, for example, and rewrite the prompts using words that their customers might use instead of those that the IRS prefers. He says that their company goal is to make things simple. Actually, he phrases it a little bit more loftier than that.
Our mission is to change lives so profoundly that people can't imagine going back to the old way. And we do that by taking the complexities of life and making them simple. We thought we were pretty good in the tax business. We thought we'd taken the complex world of taxes and made them very simple. So one woman who donated to a charity was now reporting it in TurboTax. She'd written a $2,500 check to the Heart Association. The software asked, "Well, was that cash or non-cash?" She said, "It's a check, so it wasn't cash." And she checked non-cash. Well, the next screen then asked her questions like, "What was the description of the items you donated? And how did you determine their value?" Well, she got totally flummoxed. It was a check. And that's because we'd fallen into the trap of using the words the IRS uses. And only the IRS defines cash to be a check. Any retailer will tell you that cash and a check are different. So this uncorked a major effort of simplification across the company. We changed our processes, we changed our testing, we changed our design standards, we changed our staffing, and even in TurboTax hired an editor with a background at People Magazine. The result is the new TurboTax that was used this past tax season. Here is the identical screen to do the same job as the one before, and now it's, "Did you give money to charity?" If that's not enough, we have an explanation. If that's not enough, there's a hot link. And if that's not enough, there's a video on the topic. Well, the difference has been immense. The leaps in customer ratings, which we measure, we got a 23-point gain in first-time user net promoter score. That led to big TurboTax volume gains, 27% last year, and our leading competitor shrunk.
Intuit's Scott Cook on the benefit of looking at your product from your customer's perspective. Not a new idea, but part of distributing the future. Sergey Brin, Google co-founder and president of technology, was an unexpected and unannounced guest at this year's Web 2.0 conference. Friday after lunch, John Battelle had a half-hour conversation with Brin that covered everything from the success of Google to what Google is now.
The number one factor that contributed to our success over the past 7 years is luck. I think we followed our hearts in terms of research areas and eventually found we had something pretty useful and want to be impactful about it. And it was after a lot of consternation that we really decided to go the business route. We actually talked about open sourcing the code for Google and trying to do it within universities. And it was just difficult to do that because of the computational resources that we require. We really needed to make money in order to pay for that. So eventually we did start the company, and you know, here we are a number of years later. Obviously it's been a very exciting and wild ride.
Yeah. So I wanted to, there's been a dialogue throughout the conference. Google's come up once or twice. One of the first that comes to mind is a conversation I had with Terry Semel, where I asked him about Google, and he said very respectfully how much he thinks the technology is extraordinary and of course helped Yahoo build their search technology and so on. But then he pulled back and said, but let's judge Google as what it is. Google is now a portal. And by my estimation, and I may quote him not exactly word for word, Google is number four. How do you respond to that that framing?
Based on my reading of that, that's also would make us the underdog.
Very wise. You knew my next
and,
question was...
I think that's where we are. I would add to that, if you've had the pleasure of being at the Google Cafe.
Yeah.
I think our food is pretty good. We continually try to improve it. But in terms of, kind of the volume...
Was that a non sequitur?
Well, the volume and the quantity we try to deliver, if we were to rank among cafes and restaurant chains, I mean, I don't know. We're not in the top 100 or 1,000 even, probably. So I'm...
Let me bring this one back. I like your underdog comment because it presages my next question. We asked Microsoft, about Google, and Yusuf said, well, we're the underdog now because Google's seen to be the leader. And so that gives us permission to do things that perhaps because of our reputation we couldn't have done before. Do you see Microsoft as an underdog?
I'd be excited to be viewed as a leader in terms of technology, I don't think we're the number one company out there in terms of, being able to do big business deals or to be able, or having like some huge platform or, many of the other kinds of things that Microsoft enjoys as an advantage. But from a point of view of technology development, I do think that we are a leader. And it's by virtue of all the great people we have at Google and the people who continue to join us.
Will you become, let me bring up the portal issue again. The reason you were so successful, there are many, but one of them was clean, blank page, one box, one logo. Then lots of results very quickly. Is that going to continue?
Well, I certainly hope that we'll continue to be clean. There are obviously other kinds of products and areas we've explored. And it has arisen partly out of need. For example, Gmail. I don't know how many of you here have a Gmail account. All right, we have quite a few people. That's great. But it arose out of frustration that I myself and others at the company had in terms of not being able to have a good solution to manage our own email. And I think we've done some pretty interesting things there. And on top of the effect that I think there are all those Gmail users now who have great experience, I think it's also helped people who use other email systems. I don't know if any of you who don't have the Gmail accounts and have some other webmail account, how many of you have had your sort of quota grow by a factor of 100 or so in the past year? There are areas that have been overlooked by the industry, much as search in terms of sort of search quality, relevance, was overlooked actually in the late 90s. Yeah. By the major portals at the time. So I think that we have a lot of technologies and distribution and infrastructure that really allows us to help in some of these areas, and I think we'd be foolish not to make an impact in places like that where I think we can. And we have several kinds of projects, and ones which we believe are core, and you know we're want to be strategic about, and we, you know, as an executive team, we drive forward. But a lot of the things you see are bottom-up projects, and you know, and they surprise us. Sometimes they're really fantastic. If you take Google Maps, for example, or even Google News, or in fact, probably most of our successes have nothing to do with anything any executive thought was a good idea.
Maps, mail, you know, these are things that seem to be directed, even if they're not. And I think that might create the illusion that there is a plan.
Well, that's sort of, I don't know. I feel like a lot of the portals have just sort of taken everything, kind of anything that they right. see. And I mean, I think there's still a lot that's missing. But sometimes I imagine that our teams are, you know, are dissatisfied with existing services on portals and see an opportunity to create something new. The reason that we put up so many things on labs and try so many things out and even try things that never even reach labs is because it's really hard to predict exactly what'll stick and what won't. You know, if I'd proposed to you something like Wikipedia, you know, many years ago and say, well, we'll just have these encyclopedia where anybody can edit whenever they want. I mean, I don't think many of us, including myself, would have believed that that would have worked. So these are the things that you really do have to experiment with and try.
Google co-founder Sergey Brin on Distributing the Future. We're getting ready to end our beta designation for Distributing the Future, but there's some more changes we need to make. If you have thoughts on how we should change or on stories we should cover, email us at future@O'Reilly.com or phone our new listener line and leave a message that we might air in the future. The phone is a Seattle area phone line we got by signing up with K7. The number is 206-350-0383. This information is, of course, in our show notes at O'ReillyNet.com/future. For the most part, audio is a great medium. It can do things that video or text alone can't. For most PowerPoint presentations, the audio track alone is more than sufficient. That's tough when someone uses the Lessig style of PowerPoint where the images punctuate the presentation. Dick Hart, founder and CEO of Skip's Identity, delivers a fast-paced multimedia presentation. Here's an audio-only snippet of his discussion of how you might verify your identity.
Identity is what I say about me. It's what others say about me. Of course, what others say about me is more trusted. If you meet somebody, you say your name, you say where you work, you say where you're from. So all this information is unverified. It requires that you trust the person that you're interacting with. But where do we have things like verified identity? Well, a familiar example is you go into a place like this, where in the U.S. you actually have to be over 21 to do it. You walk up to the cashier, they ask for ID, and you have a choice whether you want to present the ID and which ID you want to present. So, you know, I'll present my driver's license, and they'll look at the photo on there and compare it to the person in front of them. They see that they're the same, so the subject matches the credential. And an interesting feature of this is only I can use this credential. Then they see, well, who issued this? And is it valid? And they see, okay, yeah, it's a valid credential, assuming they trust the province of BC. And then they look at the attributes on there to go and see that I am authorized to buy my bottle of vanilla Stoli. So photo ID has significantly reduced the friction in identity transactions. And photo ID is asymmetrical around trust because there's no relationship between the province of BC and the cashier, which provides huge scalability. And the province of BC is not a participant in identity transaction, which provides a lot of privacy whenever I'm using that credential. And that credential is reusable by any recipient who trusts the issuer, in this case, a province, BC. So to summarize, identity is what I say about me, what others say about me, and modern identity provides a separation between the acquisition and the presentation of that identity and the identification process and the authorization process. And also provides scale and privacy that I control, at least most of the time.
Dick Hart on traditional identity mechanisms, his company Skip Identity, and others are looking at the implications for what he calls Identity 2.0. We're distributing the future. For many, the high point of the conference was unexpected. It was Safa Rashti's conversation with 5, 17, and 18-year-olds. He talked to them about the way they use technology, what they bought, what they liked, and what they didn't like. The results may surprise you.
The age group of 12 to 24-year-olds is about 25% of internet consumption. In fact, they spend about 30% more time than the next age group. There are about 37 million of people that are represented by this group here.
My name is Diamond LeBeau. I usually stay on the phone, actually, all day. So, and I think throughout the month, I spend probably a couple $100 on ringtones and games and downloads on my phone alone.
Hi, my name's Sean Spadiachi. When I get home from crew, all I do is, like, talk online, and I wait for people to leave me comments or messages or friend requests. Like, that's sort of, like, the highlight of my evening. And when I go to sleep, I go to sleep, and then when I wake up in the morning, I take my shower, and I go to the computer, and I check my Gmail little notifier and see if I got any messages. And if I did, then I check my MySpace to see what happened on my MySpace.
My name is Steffi Pettit. I spend most of my time on the computer on MySpace or LiveJournal, basically just to keep updated with my friends' lives and my life.
My name is Sasha Volkov, and I spend maybe an hour to, say, 4 hours, depending on home workload or whatever, online. So I do like Facebook and MySpace and all that stuff, but I try not to spend too much time on it. Mostly I use it for research if I have a paper due or something of that sort.
My name is Jake Grumbach. Most of my time spent online is, you know, for research with Google or something like that, or I spend some time on MySpace, but try to limit that, you know, and I play some PlayStation 2.
Where do you go to search?
I usually go to Google for reports, science or history or things such and such like that.
Like, I just recently did a project. I use Google, and especially Google Images, because their image search is just incredible when you want to do, like, a PowerPoint presentation. When I do music, I look at iTunes to find out, like, albums that I want, and then I'll go to a BitTorrent website. So iTunes is a great database. Look at albums you want. And, like...
I use Google for images as well, but besides that, I usually use WebCrawler or Ask Jeeves because I can type in an actual question and it'll give me a response as best as it can.
I tend to go to Google first, and then if that doesn't work, I'll go to AltaVista or Yahoo. I'll search around a lot. And in terms of file sharing, I've gotten maybe 50 songs in a day, easily. I don't pay for music anymore.
All right, so I also use Google for searching for projects, things like that. And also that little language tools thing that translates into different languages if you're doing a language project, if you need to figure out a word. That's a lot more helpful than a lot of the interlanguage dictionaries on the internet also, I think. And then I also use torrents to get those new daily shows, things like that. I just find torrents, like, you gotta have every Chappelle show, all that kind of stuff. Because it's really easy to get with torrents. And for music, I use IRC usually. And just, you can just leave things on overnight and get, like, amazing amounts of media off the internet for free, which is pretty sweet.
How do you get music into your iPod? How much of it have you downloaded? How much of it have you actually bought from iTunes?
When I first got iTunes, I actually liked the whole idea of downloading music for money, just to pay for it, because I thought it'd be nice, you know, pay the artist. But it's just that BitTorrent is just, like, it's just so easy. You could download whole albums. And, I mean, like, the whole album, I could get a whole album in, like, 30 minutes. It's, like, it's ridiculous. Like, I'd rather wait 30 minutes than wait, like, 5 minutes to either download it.
I used iTunes in terms of downloading maybe 10 times. And
how many songs do you have on your iPod?
1,500 maybe.
Okay, and how many of them have you paid for?
10 maybe.
Okay.
It's been a while.
Okay.
I actually have never paid for downloading a song, but and my iPod's broke right now, but that's okay. When I do download stuff for my iPod, I go to my friend's house and do it because either they pay for it or their internet connection is faster. Or I just go to their house and take all their songs off their iTunes and put it onto mine, so I just kind of get all the different music from my friends.
What would you like to be able to do with the web that you can't do now? Is there something that you really feel you should be able to use a web for that you wish somebody would come up with a service that you can't do now?
I want to be able to get rid of all that spyware, please. I have Adaware and it doesn't get rid of it all, so get on that, please.
You've probably noticed by now we don't like paying for things.
Right.
So the more free stuff you can come up with.
So there are probably a lot of people in this audience that are actually building the next generation of portable devices. And my question to you is, what do you want to see on those devices? Do you want BitTorrent television or movies and video? Do you want an all-in-one device that you can text people and have instant messaging plus mobile phone plus video plus music? Or what are you guys into?
Dude, do it.
So do you want to see a video iPod?
Video iPod? Yeah. Actually, that'd be awesome.
That would be a really good idea, actually. You should do that. You should put TV shows or something that you can put onto your iPod, just like the movie.
But would you
the
pay
music? Sorry.
Would you pay $3 per video to download it there?
Depends on the quality of the video and how long it is, etc. Because you're paying for a ringtone? It's $2.50, and a lot of people pay for that because they can't avoid not paying for it.
In the spirit of all of you using Instant Messenger, what more would you like to get out of your Instant Messenger?
That's it, just instant messaging. Now you're just putting ads on it, and I'm getting sort of ticked off.
Would you want to see a TV there?
No.
You can play what you want?
I'm trying to talk to my friends, not, watch TV.
We've featured the third day of this year's Web 2.0 conference in this edition of Distributing the Future. Distributing the Future is brought to you by Make Magazine, technology on your time. You'll find more information in our show notes at OReillyNet.com/future. Thanks to Vinod Khosla, Scott Cook, Sergey Brin, Dick Hart, John Battelle, and Safa Rashti. We're betaing this new show in public so that we can benefit from your comments, criticisms, and suggestions. If you have ideas to share with us, send email to future@oreilly.com or phone our listener line at 206-350-0383. I'm Daniel Steinberg. Distributing the Future is a production of O'Reilly Media. Special thanks to David Bettino for composing and performing this theme. Visit David's website at www.batmosphere.com. This program was produced on Mac OS X Tiger using Soundtrack Pro.